Welcome to Worst Year Ever, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the very first episode of Worst Year Ever. Whoa. Wow.
Yay.
Unreal.
My name's Katie Stoll. Who are you guys?
My name's... I'm Robert of the Evans from the Bastards.
Robert of the Evans from the Bastards. Mm-hmm. All right.
Full title. I'm Cody Johnston from Not That.
From Not That.
Other stuff.
From the other thing that we do together.
Yeah.
Some more news.
But also sometimes from the Bastards.
Frequently from the Bastards,
often
yeah.
From the Bastards,
frequently.
Yeah.
And I have occasionally been from the news.
That's right. There's been a lot of cross-pollination here, and this is our very first official joint jam.
Yeah, now our pollen is finally mixed together.
Oof.
It's kind of like how the outrageously like grifting, but more or less a religious wing of the Republican Party melded with the Christian Dominionist wing of the Republican Party to make our current administration, and things are going great, just like they will in this podcast.
Yeah, it is quite like that.
Yeah, we are the Republican Party.
Now, we named our show The Worst Year Ever, both in the literal sense that 2020 is going to be the worst year ever.
For everybody.
For everybody.
For me,
yeah,
for
that's
you,
mainly
for
why
them,
we called it that.
For him, for everybody.
For us.
And... it's going to be a weekly podcast in 2020. It's going to be a less than weekly podcast in 2019 as we sort of ramp up and get everyone prepared for the worst year ever. And today, I think we all kind of were looking at like what we could do to provide something of value to listeners rather than just shooting out hot takes about what's happening on the Beltway.
Right.
And I think we landed on spending hours reading about major news sources and prominent reporters and analyzing them for their biases and flaws in order to give people more context so they can critically review the news that they talk about or that they ingest over the next year. So I think that that's what we're going to do today.
That's right. We are.
Yeah.
We better be because that's what I've been doing all week.
We are not doing a different thing than that.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah. Yeah, we've talked a lot about like what we wanted this show to be, and I think the goal is to provide something of value outside of just our own opinions, so this seems like a good way to do it. Maybe we'll fuck it up. That's part of the charm of the worst year ever, is learning whether or not this all collapses in on itself like a dying star.
Yeah, I would love to be the first one to fuck it up and just get it out of the way, you know, so I'm not worried and waiting for it, but I don't mean like I have to go first, but just in general.
Like you're excited to fuck up.
Yeah, because then I won't be worried about fucking up. I just want to tear the Band-Aid off.
Yeah, because everyone knows everyone's going to fuck up, even though we're all trying our best. That's what 2020 is about, trying your best and failing miserably.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Did my best, and that's okay.
Yeah, I would say if we cut off trying your best and from trying your best and failing miserably, we would have a pretty good slogan for the Democratic Party.
Failing miserably, yes, absolutely.
Existing and failing miserably.
You know, it's not a bad slogan for this podcast either, just putting that out there.
Yeah. That's a good slogan for all of us. So, Cody, why don't you take us in? Because you have a mandolin, and that seems to qualify you to start first.
I do. That's why I carry it around wherever I go.
Is that part of your...
You do.
Your... presentation today?
Yeah, it's my outfit now. It's my whole deal. Yeah.
It's certainly an accessory.
It gets me in at the front of the line.
It's Cody trying to be like Jeff Daniels on the last episode in the newsroom where they have an impromptu jam band session for like, no reason.
By the way, here's 4 minutes of a song in a garage.
Actually, John Lovett wrote for, that's something
that for the newsroom?
Yeah, he worked on
the newsroom. Oh my gosh, did you write that
briefly.
Scene where they're on the plane and they're like, we reported the news.
Do not know. All I know is after his sitcom 1600 Pen. Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
1600 Penn failed. Yeah. Then he worked on the newsroom before going to
1600 Penn was comedy legend Bill Pullman.
Anyway, that's from my section. Hold on.
Listeners should know there was a TV show by Aaron Sorkin of The West Wing called The Newsroom, which was about an idealized dumb person's idea of what a very centrist news network would look like. And there's a scene in it where several of the characters are on a plane and people on the plane start getting weird text messages because it's the day that Bin Laden got shot. And they start start worrying that like the news trickling in about how the president's going to address the nation means there's been a big terrorist attack. And the brave journalists in the plane decide that they need to essentially hijack the flight to tell everybody that there hasn't been a terrorist attack and Bin Laden's dead. And all of the plane people get angry at them until they hear that Bin Laden's dead, and then they all start hugging.
Right, because he also
he's
like really mad at the captain and the crew of the plane.
Super
until,
angry
until he sees like
their Delta.
Right, it's like the Delta insignia,
and the
like,
fifth branch of the armed forces.
Right. Swells, and he gets very self-important and serious. He's like, "Captain, I'm here to inform you that we killed Osama Bin Laden for you." And they all hug and like. The handshake and oh, it's amazing. It's
amazing.
It's really self-important and really cringy.
And
it's really
my goal for this podcast is that at some point in 2020, when the three of us are on a plane headed to a convention of some sort, or you know, a major political event or rally, we have a chance to do that. But rather than it being about a terrorist being shot, it's us informing the plane that one of our elderly candidates has soiled himself on a national stage. That is my dream. Yeah,
and I don't think we'll have
to wait. I wanted you
long.
To know first, Captain. That at 14 minutes past noon, Joseph Biden soiled himself while arguing with Bernie Sanders.
Yep.
I probably would have said shot himself. But
yeah.
Yes.
You better get on a plane soon because that's happening tonight.
Okay. Let's actually get into this episode that we've recorded.
We've picked various organizations. So we're going to talk about NPR briefly.
Yeah.
And because it's NPR, we all are aware of it. A brief history of NPR. It seems simple enough. NPR, it began being a thing that exists in 1970 after the passage of the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. The first broadcast was actually coverage of the congressional hearings on Vietnam. And they launched their flagship show, All Things Considered, which, you know, I mean, kind of an impossible claim. Like all of the things? Come on. And then they added Morning Edition 8 years later. They actually almost went bankrupt in the early 80s, and then they sort of restructured how things work. They've got like thousands of member stations throughout the country, and they sort of pay a fee to them to get their content. Recently, as of 2009, 26% of their budget comes from corporate sponsors, which I think sets off
some alarms.
Well, a little bit, but you know. But
how else are you going to know they're going to consider all things?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. If it's only publicly funded, then you're not considering the big corporate interests. So, you know, fair.
Exactly.
Fair.
Balanced. Consider Pepsi. Mm-hmm. Consider Coca-Cola. That's both of them. Those are the two that you have.
Those are the options.
Those are the options. There is nothing else. They actually also have to adhere to the truth in advertising rules. So, like, you'll notice on NPR, it's never promoting a product. Mm-hmm. It's just describing it, which is not, you know, that significant, but it's a thing that a lot of people should do on their ads. We'll get to their bias and stuff. We don't need to talk about their many scandals, of which there are not many. In the midst of the Me Too movement, the head of news, the senior VP and editorial director, Michael Oreskes, was accused by two women who said that he unexpectedly kissed them.
Mm.
Wait for it. And stuck his tongue in their mouths.
Aww.
There's more. During job interviews.
Well, okay, that's pretty egregious. But also, if he hadn't done that, then they couldn't have considered it.
Exactly. So,
and you have to consider all things.
All things. Exactly.
Which they actually did consider, because later, like less than a week later, on All Things Considered, they reported another woman who had reported his behavior to HR in 2015. So they considered everything.
Well, good for them.
He no longer works
there.
That
sounds considerate. Yeah.
He's no longer with them. So in terms of their bias, do they have it? How much of it? They're actually the most trusted news source in America, which isn't surprising.
No.
Although that only means that 61% of America thinks they're trustworthy. So like, I don't know, our institutions are crumbling, and our trust in our institutions is also crumbling, and that seems like a problem, right?
Yeah, you are considered trustworthy if only 39% of America thinks you are literal lizard people.
Exactly. So congratulations to NPR on probably not being lizard people.
I'm not convinced.
Well, we'll work on that, all right? I can convince you. You would be the third of the people who don't. Katie, you're on board with them not being lizard people?
Yeah, I'm on board with that.
Okay, me too. Okay, perfect. That math works out. They've also been accused of bias from everybody, like most people.
Yeah, but, I don't know how you get escape without being accused of bias.
Right, the right's going to accuse you of bias, the left's going to accuse you of bias. That's just how it is. They do have an interesting relationship with the Pentagon. Just in that, one of the main criticisms, I think, of them is often when they get, like, a press release from the Pentagon where they will simply read it at face value and have, like, no analysis, no sort of questioning the intent behind it or the truth behind it. Sort of a similar thing with interviews they do. Mm-hmm. Which, again, I think this is going to be a theme of just sort of these big institutions not necessarily questioning the government or military organizations. Less of a right-left bias and more a governmental sort of thing, yeah. They also, notably, were very pro-war in Iraq, as, again, we'll see many people be that.
Well, I mean, I think that worked out pretty well. We knocked that statue down, and now Iraq is doing pretty good, right?
I don't want to pause the show, but maybe you should Google for a while. You want to spend a little time on Google?
Oh, no. See, oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
All you had to do was type the word Iraq. Oh, no. One other thing I think that of note, they made a point to refuse to refer to the Bush administration's torture at Gitmo as torture. They went along with the sort of the enhanced interrogation language.
Oh, sure. Did they get that from the Pentagon?
Yeah. I mean, that's what they wanted everybody to call it. So they called it enhanced interrogation. This sort of like newspeak, one might refer to it. I think it's reminiscent of something we're also seeing now with the current situation regarding concentration camps for migrants, which the government enjoys referring to as temporary emergency influx shelters, which I don't think NPR is referring to them as. But so they just sort of have this relationship that is a little not questioning of organizations like that. In terms of bias, again, we'll get into more of this with the New York Times and Washington Post. It's less left or right, more about the military. But whenever I think about NPR's possible bias, I actually think of a specific interview conducted by David Rubin.
Oh, God.
Who I know we're probably a little too familiar with. We're not here to talk about Rubin in terms of like a source of news. That would be silly. We're not going to talk about like the grifters or anything like that. But in 2017, David Rubin interviewed Ken Stern. He's a former CEO of NPR, who had written a book called How I Left the Liberal Bubble and Learned to Love the Right. If you're familiar with Rubin, you can guess that the majority of his interview tried to steer Stern into complaining about the left and praising the right, despite his book actually being more about like the importance of conversation and not like the left is bad and I'm leaving it. You know, during the interview, Rube kept coming back to the idea of like liberals saying like conservatives are the real heroes, saying the NPR is useless, saying the NPR is incredibly biased and that the government just shouldn't do anything about it, especially like when it comes to thing like NPR. Basically, he continued to bring up the idea that like, what if a private company did NPR instead? Why does the government do any of this at all? That familiar dance we're all familiar with. to Stern's credit, he was very polite in vehemently disagreeing with all of Dave's horse shit, repeatedly pointing out that one of the important things about NPR isn't like the fancy, like the liberal elite with their genderqueer lattes, but rather it's for the small towns across the country that without NPR, they wouldn't have like local news and the kinds of access that they do to this information. That's what NPR does.
Which is a big problem with the news organization, news at large right now, is that people don't have access to like
They don't have local news, and not having access to local news actually makes people more polarized. So he kept pointing this out. They're like, well, actually NPR is really good, it brings all this information to people across the country. And one thing he didn't mention, NPR runs the public radio satellite system, which is not just used by NPR, it's used by everybody, so way to go space. My point, though, in bringing up David Rubin is, so like the former CEO of NPR, who wrote a book about leaving the liberal bubble, face to face with Dave Rubin, asked over and over again about NPR's bias for more than an hour, still disagrees with him. The closest he came to was saying that like maybe there's some sort of unconscious bias, but there's nobody there who's just sort of deciding to tell one side of the story. To which Dave says, I don't believe you.
Okay.
And that, well, don't you think maybe there's like an unconscious sort of thing going on? Which is like, yeah, he literally just said that, Dave.
Yeah.
It's a very funny interview. I'm getting off track. I didn't want to talk about Dave Rubin.
Here we are, though.
But here we are. But the point being that like, in terms of like their bias, even this guy won't say, like, oh, yeah, they're, like, a bunch of lefties who are, like, pushing out conservatives. They do give, more often than not, like, both sides of the story equal weight.
Yeah. Would you say that they try to make sure that all things are considered?
No.
No.
Ooh, that's a little clunky. Like, that okay. phrase is a little clunky. I wouldn't TM that.
All right.
Like, considering most of... every of the things, I think.
Okay,
like,
okay, that's much cleaner. Yeah. Okay, sorry, continue.
Yeah.
I can say for, like, when my father, who's very conservative and a Trump voter, when we talk about political bias and where he gets his news, his go-to for, I listen to left-wing news, is NPR. Like, that is to him the left-wing take on things.
That's
yeah.
a bummer.
And, yeah, I've had some pretty productive discussions with him where I'm like, there's actually really no voice for, like, an actual left wing in the American media. Like, liberals obviously dominate the media. They're, I would say, more than 60%. But, like, Hillary Clinton's a liberal. She's not a leftist.
Right.
Like, Bernie Sanders is barely, by most nation standards, would be, like, kind of in the center left. Like, there's no... like
right.
NPR, it's reasonably fair, and I think like kind of the core of what your essay is getting at, Cody, is that like they're certainly valuable and it's good that they exist, but they're like kind of a centrist voice that doesn't really challenge the status quo outside of like kind of in very specific instances. Like every now and then you'll get a piece like I actually found Serial Season 2 had some really good sort of critiques about a chunk of the country that I came from. And about like the way that the media covers them. But like, you know, for the most part, they're trying to present sort of the things are more or less fine. The system just needs fine tuning.
Right.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. I think that as we go through all of this, we're going to see that the theme throughout it is like, yeah, these networks, I'm going to talk about MSNBC. We perceive it as a liberal network, but the reality is that it's really pretty centrist. It's really pretty moderate, except for like some people that they have on, like a show is maybe a bit more left leaning, but in general it is. And like, there's just such a polarization in our country that the trying to stick to the facts has now become liberal. You're super liberal when it's like actually not. And they're so towing the line, trying not to come across as being biased. So it's a bit of a clusterfuck.
Yeah. I sort of get into that too with the New York Times and Washington Post because this is a pet peeve of mine. This, like, the term liberal media, like the left-wing media,
right.
What they always mean, almost always, is corporate media.
Yeah.
And we should bring that back and start saying that because that is really what it is. It's not like, oh yeah, all the those MSNBC folks wanting to, you know, eat the rich or whatever. I don't recall that happening. So that's NPR in a nutshell. I think that they're a fine source for like what's happening, not necessarily like an analysis of what's going on or what could happen or what needs to be done. And honestly, like, yeah, if Robert's dad is listening to NPR, even though he thinks it's liberal, I think that's good.
Yeah, it's just good to keep in mind.
Yeah,
it's good that he's getting exposed to something besides Fox News.
Exactly.
It's unfortunate that those are the options, but yeah.
All right.
Before we continue, though, I'm sorry. You both need to shut up because it's time for advertisements.
Okay, that was a bit aggressive.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Fine.
I'm fine with this because I hate all of our opinions, but I love products.
Me too.
Heck yes.
Welcome to the worst year ever. Together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
And we're back again.
Still.
We're back again still.
Speaking of not Fox News, should I talk about Jake Tapper now? J-Taps?
Sure.
I'm going to call him J-Taps regularly. So Jake Tapper is the chief DC correspondent for CNN. He headlines a show called The Lead, which is a weekday TV news show. He also has a Sunday show. And according to a lot of people, he's basically the closest thing that we in 2019 have to a guy like Walter Cronkite. In March of 2018, The New Republic published an article titled "Why Almost, in parentheses, Everyone Likes Jake Tapper." And that's basically the theme of the article, is that like J-Taps is our best shot at a new Walter Cronkite. And since like nobody listening to the show was alive when Walter Cronkite was on the air. He was this anchorman for CBS Evening News throughout like the entirety of the 60s and the 70s, pretty much. And he was considered the most trusted man in America for about 20 years. And so, you know, because we're in this post-truth era where nothing is real, and nobody can agree on even basic facts about science, a lot of people are desperate for a voice of reason who can get Americans united behind some sort of like basic minimal understanding of the facts, which is an impulse I understand. I get wanting that.
Yeah. I think we all would like that to happen.
Yeah. Keep dreaming.
Yeah. It would be nice if we could just all agree that the climate's changing. As the largest hurricanes in history continue to batter our shores.
That it's changing and why it's changing and that we could do something about it.
Right.
That you know what, Cody? Nice. I'll start with that it's changing.
All right.
So that New Republic article basically made the case, that Jake Tapper was like our new most trusted man in America. And it included quotes from a bunch of left and right wing pundits. All these guys, it included all these people with different views, like expressing respect for Jake Tapper. One example is this quote from Nick Gillespie, an editor at Reason Magazine, which is like the libertarianist large magazine or news source in the country. Tapper is the only person who, when I see him on TV, I stop to listen no matter what. He forces people who think Sheriff Scott Israel is a good guy to face up to the fact that Israel is kind of full of shit, and he pushes Dana Loesch and the NRA to really explain their contradictions when it comes to recently stated ideas about gun policy. I mean, I'm a libertarian, so I hesitate to say anything is a public service, but that's kind of a great public service he's doing. So that's now, coverage.
There's no public service? Like,
Yeah, I hesitate to say anything is a public service, but here's a public service being provided by this guy who's works for a private corporate media company. Libertarians are consistent above all else. Now, the exact coverage that Gillespie was referencing there is kind of part of the reason I question Tapper's value as an impartial voice. Scott Israel was the Broward County Sheriff when the Parkland shooting happened. His department was rightfully criticized for its piss-poor response to the massacre, which some characterized as basically waiting while kids died out of, cowardice. Mm-hmm. Tapper gained mass approval from the right wing when he conducted a penetrating and deeply critical interview of Israel, saying things like, "Just so people watching at home understand, even after the shooter left the school, there was a period of time where nobody was going into the school. No law enforcement officers. People were bleeding out." Now, for this, Glenn Beck declared Jake Tapper the number one journalist in the nation. Ben Shapiro called it a perfect interview. But days later, when Tapper held a special CNN town hall on gun violence and held Republican feet to the fire on gun control, the right-wing reaction was much less positive. Ben Shapiro called it a show trial on behalf of full gun bans. So the New Republic article shows this as like an example of how he's widely respected by all sides. This just seems like an example of the fact that when Jake Tapper reinforces people's beliefs, they like him. And when his coverage doesn't, they hate him. Like, I don't know.
Right. He did something they liked. And so they're like, oh, he's perfect. And then days later, they changed their mind because he did something else. Like, that's not.
Yeah.
It's Twitter culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's Twitter culture. Some people, like the writer at the New Republic who wrote that piece, consider this as evidence that he's universally respected. Like I said, I don't know that I really agree with that. And I don't see any evidence that, like, any of these pundits who've praised him for specific things he's done have, like, seriously reconsidered their views because of anything he's reported on. And I may just be a pessimist here, but I kind of worry a little bit about Tapper's reputation for fairness. I think it matters a lot to him, and I think the word fairness should set your hackles arise whenever it's used to apply to a journalist. Mm-hmm. Journalism is not about fairness. It's about the truth, and the truth is often not fair. Journalists should be capable of looking at issues from an objective point of view, but that doesn't mean they need to present both sides of every issue as equally valid. It just means they need to be able to evaluate the evidence before presenting their audience with the truth. And I'm not going to say Tapper is inherently bad at this. He's actually done pretty well sometimes, at least compared to the rest of the media. And this brings me to how J-Taps first became a national name. Are you guys aware of what his first big story was?
I don't believe that I am.
I can't wait to find out.
Okay. So he wrote a very widely read article for Washington City paper. For the Washington City paper about Monica Lewinsky right after that scandal broke. And the article was probably the most sympathetic piece written about Miss Lewinsky by a mainstream journalist, like at the time when she was under attack by every reporter and hack comedian in the country. Yeah. So like, you know, Monica Lewinsky becomes public enemy number one for Democrats and a lot of liberals. And Jake Tapper writes a very sympathetic piece, like making her out as like a full and complete human being who's like not a monster and like not doing this to try to like scam some money out of Bill Clinton or whatever. So that's good, right? Like that's a positive thing to do.
Don't now, disappoint me.
There's some problematic aspect. Like I'll say this in fairness to Jake, his article was probably the fairest article about Monica Lewinsky that came out through like a really mainstream site or like a news source at the time. But that doesn't mean it wasn't also problematic. Its title was I Dated Monica Lewinsky.
What?
Yeah, yeah. So Jake Tapper had gone on a date with Monica Lewinsky before the scandal broke. The framing of the piece is that our man J-Taps is out on a diving trip in the Cayman Islands. And as he's like at an airport, the scandal breaks and he reads about it in a local newspaper. And the fact that he'd just been diving does not really directly interface with any aspect of the story, but he brings it up constantly throughout the piece. And
I'm a diver in my free time. It takes a lot of lung capacity.
He like talks about barracudas and how like you know when
does he compare her to a barracuda?
No, but he talks about how like disorienting it is to like get reacclimated to the 24-hour news cycle after being away from it, and how it's like diving more than two atmospheres down, and how you have to slowly like
it's poetic.
It's really frustrating.
Oh, that's going to stick forever now. Jake Tapper, the diver. That's all I think of him now.
He loves his diving, or at least he did at one point in 1998. Mm-hmm. It also might be the only time he went diving, and he just had to get some words out
right,
on
it's
it.
Like,
I don't know.
I got to do a metaphor. What am I going to... Ah, where was I? Okay, yeah, perfect.
Fish! So the core of the article is that, yeah, he went on a dinner date with Monica Lewinsky before the scandal broke, and he thought she was a nice girl. He repeatedly talks about how she's different from other D.C. career-oriented women. He makes two separate references to her weight, calling her zaftig and chubby at different points.
He
makes
this.
A third reference to how she eats appetizers and not salad, which he does present as positive, but is really weird in context.
Yeah, you don't need to comment on that, bud.
He does repeatedly.
Also, one date doesn't mean you dated. Sorry.
Now, Katie, do you think Jake Tapper talked about whether or not he fucked Monica Lewinsky in this article he wrote for a mainstream news source?
Oh, no, he didn't. Did he?
He so did.
No,
he didn't. He didn't fuck her, but he talked about how she didn't fuck him. I'm going to quote a selection from that selection from the piece, because it really says a lot about Jake Tapper. Quote, "And to be brutally honest, I got with her because I figured that behind her initial aggressiveness lurked an easy, perhaps winning, bit of no-frills hookup. Nothing of the kind happened, so either I am imminently resistible, which is certainly within the realm of possibility, or Monica is not the tart she's being made out to be."
What?
Yeah.
I am nauseated. There's more?
There's more! Yeah, maybe if I had the Marines under my command, things would have been different.
Wait.
But I'm not so sure.
All right, okay. Go on.
I mean, he sounds like, you know, he's
a little incel.
Maybe I would have got the military to force her to... Oh my God, Jake, all right.
Power does weird things to people. More than once, I have found myself laughing my ass off and nodding in agreement while some fading star has held forth on something I could care less about. Offended me, even. Does that make me a nitwit? A himbo waiting to happen? I think it just makes me toweringly average in Washington. Just another creature who is here because that is where the national vat of power lies. And I'm sitting here waiting for my bowl full.
Huh.
Oh. So he knows.
Yeah. So he knows. He knows who he is.
He knows who he is and why he's there and what he's doing, what he wants. All right.
Wow.
Also, props for the term himbo.
Oh, my
gosh.
Yeah,
that's clever.
Such a 90s term. Mm-hmm.
Himbo? I've never heard that term before.
Oh, it's super 90s.
Knowing where
it's a bimbo, but him?
Yeah. It's a male. A male bimbo.
Okay.
One might say a mimbo or whatever.
I would go with mimbo.
Yeah. Or just neither.
Knowing where like news budgets were before the internet really took hold, my imagination of that the day that he came up with that frame is he like sat down at his computer for about 4 minutes, like staring at that paragraph, wrote bimbo and then deleted the word B and added an H and said, That's enough for the day. I'm going to collect my $4,000 and
he's like,
go out to
win.
Dinner. Yeah.
I'm going to win an award for this.
That's submitted. A Pulitzer.
Saint and send. Yep.
For your approval, America.
Yeah. Now, in more recent days, Jake's commitment to fairness and to listening to voices on all sides of the political aisle has led to him getting played by right-wing grifters. Mm. Regular listeners of Behind the Bastards, my other podcast, will have heard the episode I did on Andy Ngo, a Portland area news grifter. He was famously attacked by Antifa. This was presented in the mainstream media as an unprovoked assault by anti-fascists against a journalist just doing his job. Now, video was later released that showed Andy participating in a right-wing mob as it armed itself, planned, and carried out an unprovoked assault on a left wing cider bar on May Day. A young woman was struck from behind and had her spine broken as part of that assault. This was one of the major inciting incidents of the attack on Ngo a month later. He wasn't hit for being a journalist. He was hit for being part of a violent right-wing street gang. Now, that doesn't make it right, but time and context has shown that presenting his assault as Antifa attacks a journalist for no reason was deeply inaccurate. Nonetheless, Andy was able to grift like $200,000 and provided fuel for the government to declare Antifa a domestic terrorist group in the weeks before that video dropped. He was able to do all of this, in large part, thanks to Jake Tapper. Within minutes of the assault, Jay Taps retweeted Andy's video of himself, you know, after he got hit, saying, and Jake said, quote, Antifa regularly attacks journalists. It's reprehensible.
Okay.
Jake, do they?
Jake? They do not. They just do not. I've been around them dozens of times. I know dozens of journalists who have. I have watched them shove cameras a couple of times. There are isolated incidents where individuals have punched. Like, one of the most famous ones is Taylor Lorenz, who wrote recently for The Atlantic, I think now is with The New York Times. She got punched by an anti-fascist during the 2017 Charlottesville rally. She was punched because immediately after the terrorist attack that killed Heather Heyer, she was filming, and this person, in a very emotionally charged time, hit her. It doesn't make it right. Obviously, there's some defensible cases as a journalist for filming in the wake of something like that, but declaring that a guy who has just watched someone get murdered in a terrorist attack having an extreme emotional reaction and punching a journalist does not equate to Antifa regularly punches right. journalists. They just don't. Like,
and they know that. He knows that.
He should know that.
I don't know that he does. Yeah. I don't know that he does. I think Jake Tapper is addicted to this reputation he has of, like, showing both sides. And this video, with no context, looked like a clear case of how he could, like, attack a left-wing group and get a win with the right. And I think that's more important to Jake than actually, and also having a take on this thing that had happened and became the biggest news story of the day was more important to him than doing any sort of research, digging into the issue, and figuring out what was going on like a journalist. I do think Jake Tapper probably was a journalist at one point. And, like, one of the things I can respect about him is he actually had got his start doing a lot of, like, freelancing and stuff. So, you know, he had to work his way up to an extent. But what he's doing now and what he did with Andy Ngo was not journalism. It was punditry, and it was wildly irresponsible and dangerous punditry. So when Jake Tapper does something like arrange a discussion between people like Marco Rubio and, like, some of the Parkland kids about gun control, that's a good thing. I'm glad that existed. I'm glad he was a part of that. I'm not going to say he's always bad or you should never trust him on anything. He clearly has his skills. That said, you should be wary about trusting him or his coverage when he comments on something he has not personally investigated at any depth, because he seems to have an addiction to being seen as a fair and balanced reporter of both sides, and that can be taken advantage of.
Yeah, he wants his bowl full of power.
Yeah, he wants his bowl full of power.
We have to take a quick break for an ad. Though,
God, I love ads. Are we going to consider this?
We are considering all things.
Yeah, it's one of the things, so
it's
we will consider
things,
it. Yeah.
So let's all just take a moment to consider this.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
Wowee.
There are some ads.
Oh, I bought all of them.
Already?
Ah,
I
yeah.
am... I am as hard as a pipe rail gate, y'all, thanks to those ads.
Oh, good. That's exactly where I need you to be to talk about MSNBC and Rachel Maddow. So that's perfect.
Yeah, I'm trying to make this show accessible to my fellow Southerners, so I compared my penis to something that would appear on a farm.
And you know what? We all appreciated it.
Yeah.
And learned something about you and about farms.
And
cool.
And your friends and your dick and... Just learning a lot of stuff right now.
All right, let's learn some stuff about MSNBC, all right?
Ooh.
Okay, MSNBC is one of the farthest reaching channels in the country, reaching about 81% of households with cable. That's a lot. MSNBC was launched in 1996 as a partnership between NBC and Microsoft, but note, NBC at that time was owned by General Electric. By and large, it is considered to be a liberal network, you know, like we talked about just a few minutes before this, but I would actually say that it's just more liberal leaning. A lot of people out there consider MSNBC to be the Fox News of the left and Rachel Maddow to be the left's Sean Hannity, which is ultimately not fair, but there are some strands of truth to that, which we're going to get to in a minute. But yeah, in reality, it is very much a moderate network with predominantly moderate hosts and shows like Morning Joe and Chris Matthews. And in general, MSNBC is very much in line with the Democratic establishment. Actually, a 2017 Pew Research poll found that MSNBC was the number two choice for people who backed Hillary Clinton. And another interesting little tidbit that I found is that apparently Fox News viewers are more likely to back Bernie Sanders than people who watch MSNBC. This is according to a Morning Consult poll, which said that 22% of Fox News viewers who also identified as potential Democratic primary voters back Sanders compared to just 13% of MSNBC viewers. So, you know, that kind of says a lot about the demographics of MSNBC and how they tend to skew. But all of that said, MSNBC does also attract a lot of progressives and Bernie voters, specifically to the Rachel Maddow show. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about Rachel. She was born Catholic family, Castro Valley, California. She got her BA at Stanford, was the first openly gay Rhodes Scholar in American history. Yeah, I know. That's pretty cool. Oh, she also got outed by her school newspaper at Stanford. For being gay. She hadn't told her parents yet, but they like did a piece about her. Yeah. She did her graduate and doctoral work at Lincoln College, Oxford, and has a PhD in politics. As I mentioned, she's openly gay. She's been with her partner Susan since 1999. This doesn't have much to do with the news, but I just wanted to share this one little fact is that they never got married, which is no big deal, but she's openly commented a few times that she actually thinks gay marriage denigrates gay culture. That it like detracts from how they recognize long-term relationships. And that's gotten a lot of flack from other people. I mean, I don't identify as gay, but I've heard, you know, I've seen comments and Reddit threads about that, people being pretty disappointed with it. But anyway, Rachel started her career in radio in Massachusetts after she won a contest to be a morning co-host for Dave in the Morning. She then eventually joined Air America in 2004. And then got her own two-hour Rachel Maddow radio program. And that's when her star began to rise and she started becoming a frequent guest on MSNBC, specifically on the long-forgotten Tucker Carlson show. Remember when Tucker
MSNBC's
Carlson...
MSNBC's Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, MSNBC's Tucker Carlson. yeah, she... I guess she was invited on to regularly get his goat. You know, back then, Tucker was still a conservative, but, you know, he had some sort of morals still, I guess. But then, you know, he left for Fox News and turned into a cockroach. And she was given her own hour-long show on MSNBC. Surprisingly, Rachel has said about herself in interviews that she has never and still don't think of myself as an Obama supporter, either professionally or actually. And she feels liberated by having a professional role in which it's probably better for me to not take sides. And I included that because that was pre-Trump. So it's maybe a little less hypocritical than it sounds and more like, no, it's kind of hypocritical. But it is foreshadowing for how much she would change in the near future. Like I said, Rachel is MSNBC's probably their most liberal host. And she is pretty biased. She's been beating this Russia drum the entirety of this administration,
every night.
Although, according to interviews, she apparently sees herself as not a partisan and calls herself a national security liberal. And I'm not, what do you guys think that means? Because I don't know.
That's a liberal who gets, if you'll pardon the term, hard whenever we shoot missiles at somebody. That, like, a national security liberal is like the mainstream of TV guys who, when we launched those cruise missiles at one of Bashar al-Assad's air bases, talked about the beauty of our weapons.
Yeah,
that's
Brian
a
Williams.
National security
and,
liberal. Yeah.
I thought that might be it, but it was very confusing to me because she was also very against the Iraq war. She wrote a lot about it, did a lot of reporting about that. So that was a bit confusing to me, but that's how she identifies.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, let's talk about post-2016 Rachel. Like I said, kind of lost her mind over this Russia investigation. And look, on an emotional level, I do get it. This was this huge mystery. We have no trust in the government that they would conduct an effective investigation. And we understand that journalists do a lot of work breaking stories. However, what she's done is different. She's meandered into conspiracy theories. You know, night after night, she presents this ever-building sense of anticipation. She spins stories and theorized and planted seeds of conspiracy that absolutely ratcheted up the hysteria. You know, again, 81% of households watch, you know, like get MSNBC, while also ignoring actually important things that were happening on a day-to-day basis.
I would call her like one side, like there's two different ways in which liberal or left-wing journalists fucked up coverage of Russiagate. On one side, you've got Rachel Maddow, who makes it into this gigantic, like, and really like clear conspiracy, which it wasn't. And so like by getting people to expect that, she did huge damage to like getting people to take seriously the actual crimes that were committed. And then on the other side, you've got Glenn Greenwald, who insisted like nothing really wrong was done. And like there was nothing to focus on in there, which is also untrue because there was a lot of shady shit that went down.
But it like it really was at a detriment to the actual findings of the investigation and to what we expect, you know, and and, you know, when she kept promises, the way she built it up, it always met. It always felt like the hammer is about to fall. And so not
she
only
Al Capone's vaulted it. Al Capone's vaulted it.
It's like, and it's so not only is it deflating what we actually find, but I think it contributes a lot to people's burnout throughout these years.
Yeah. And like, like just building up expectations and dashing them. She did a similar thing with his tax returns at one point.
Yes, exactly, right. When she says, we've got them.
Yeah, like there's a whole thing. Everyone's like on Twitter like, oh, we got to everyone tune into Rachel Maddow for the tax returns. And like, it was not really anything. It's like, well, why didn't you look into that before you did this whole thing?
Yeah, or you knowingly, you knew that people were
like
disappointed,
I say, look into
you,
it, but you did.
You pumped it up. So anyway, you know, I just think it's important to note all of that because if we're going to criticize Fox News, let's say, for being irresponsible with their reporting, you really have to do the same thing for Rachel Maddow. And interestingly, she was just hit with a $10 million defamation lawsuit from the OAN network. What is the OAN network? Well, that stands for One American News, which is a small family-owned conservative network based in San Diego. That's currently been challenging Fox News for, you know, conservative cable viewers. You may also remember them for receiving a lot of favorable attention recently from Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Obviously, he loves...
They've got some programming on that show.
They do.
It looks like it's filmed on a green screen in someone's garage.
It's so weirdly bad.
Lo-fi, yeah.
Anyway, they're suing Rachel for calling them paid Russia propaganda on air. I guess Comcast, which owns MSNBC, had refused to carry the OAN network. And then a couple weeks later, Rachel discussed a story that was first broke by the Daily Beast about an OAN employee who also worked for Sputnik News. And she built to the point that in this case, the most obsequiously pro-Trump right-wing news outlet in America really, literally is paid Russian propaganda. And also, their on-air U.S. politics reporter is paid by the Russian government to produce propaganda for that government. But this isn't actually accurate. The reporter, Ukrainian, I believe, Christian Ruz, was a freelancer for Sputnik News, not a staff employee. And according to the lawsuit, his work there has nothing to do with his work at OWN. And yeah, I just poked around a little
bit. Yeah, if he worked for Sputnik, it is literally accurate to say that he is a paid employee of the Russian intelligence apparatus because that's who runs Sputnik News. That said, that doesn't make her claim that OAN is like literally Russian propaganda accurate. But if this guy wrote thousands of articles for Sputnik, he absolutely was paid by the Russian security establishment.
Right. But anything that he did, but like what he's doing on the OAN network he doesn't talk about anything Russia is what I'm getting to. Like, yes, he has worked for them in the past. So there's like this grain and like, yes, that's something interesting to note.
Yeah, consider
but
that.
But like and... talking about it on, you know, this highly popular program that she has and framing it as he's literally being paid by the Russian government to put propaganda in the American news stream isn't accurate.
It's hard to prove. Maybe
there's a world where it is, but that's not a provable thing based on what she has. And it's an irresponsible thing, in my opinion, to put out there on the air.
It's a kind of Louise Menchie.
Yes.
Just that sort of like everyone is, everyone's a Russian troll or a Russian bot or a Russian asset.
Yeah.
No matter what you say.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my little bit about Rachel Maddow. And like, I have enjoyed her at times. I think that she's incredibly intelligent and I think she asks good questions. Like, she has done some great interviews. She does follow up consistently with people, but I've stopped watching her program personally because I can't, I don't like to have to sift through what is, you know, not necessarily true. What's her theorizing? Right. It's frequently like, you know, could this be a plant? Could, you know, have they taken over our government? She says things like that regularly.
Yeah, she's got a lot of that Charlie Day energy with the strings on the wall and stuff.
Yeah.
And like some of it is true, like that she says, because she's a reporter. She like you said, she's intelligent. She researches stuff. But a lot of it is just like putting strings, connecting them to other photos and stuff.
Yeah.
I think she's a perfect example of how toxic TV news is, because you've got this person who is an intelligent, thoughtful person. And if she had limited her journalism career to heavily researching and putting out a limited number of articles or videos on subjects she'd investigated thoroughly, she'd probably have done some great work. But because she was putting out like it's a nightly show. You've got to like drive up viewership and do this Al Capone's vault bullshit where you have to hype it up and get people listening, which means that like you're constantly there's no way to responsibly get that much useful news out to people on that kind of a schedule. So you're going to essentially wind up lying to them about what you have on a regular basis, which like is part of why nobody trusts or believes in anything even anymore. And I'm not saying like Rachel Maddow is responsible for the death of truth. Her career is an example of a piece of the death of truth and like how toxic. Don't listen to TV news. Don't watch TV news. It's bad. It's killing everything.
I've stopped. You know, I used to trying to get the different perspectives, but you weren't really getting different perspectives.
You pad everything and then you sensationalize everything and then it falls apart.
Yeah. It takes like no really like the best journalists in the world right now get maybe a dozen really good scoops a year.
Yeah.
Right, because you take your time also. Like when news
You take
breaks,
a long time. Yeah. Yeah. You put work into it. You know, outside of like reporting. Yeah.
You want to take like, okay, the thing happened. I could have a take like a Jake Tapper. I could have a take right now, or I could wait because, but you can't wait. It has to be immediate. Everything's immediate with 24-hour news and Twitter now. Yeah. So it's just, it's all poisoned.
It's all poisoned. Stop watching. That's the thing. Like I've talked, like my parents are both Trump voters. And so I talk to them regularly about what they consume news-wise. And we have a lot of arguments, some friendly, some not so friendly about like, you know, my attempting to get them to like pay attention to stuff that's not Fox News, and they do, but it's always other TV news. And like, they finally ask like, well, what else should we be watching? I'm like, don't watch it. Like read reported articles. Like that's what's important. Don't fill your brain with like this daily flood of, we have to get something out, you know, by 5 this afternoon. So like, we're not going to look into it at all. We're just going to shit out like whatever story we have. Like, it's the same thing that with like Jake Tapper and the shit happening in Portland. You've got this story that's been going on for 3 years and it's very complicated. And a bunch of journalists have devoted thousands of hours to like reporting it and studying it. And then Jake just bulges in and was like, you got to get something out today. It's 9 words. Like it's
gotta
the same.
Gotta get something out today.
I don't know that we're going to have time to talk about The Daily. I also looked into that. There was not much to say about it, but that's a pretty thoughtful podcast and the antithesis of what we're just talking about, because they don't do things right away. They'll still make it topical, but they're going to take a beat to craft something, you know, right. and to interview people and get a couple different people to talk about. So The Daily is a good podcast you can check out. It's every day. Between 20 and 30 minutes.
Right, so they're preparing these topics, and then, like, if it has to do with the news, they'll tie it in.
It's thoughtful. Yeah. And not sensationalist, but honest. You know, I haven't listened to all of them. I'm sure they've made some missteps.
So you can have a good reporting and honest reporting on a daily basis. Yeah. You just have to, take the time.
It has to be varied, because, like, what they do on The Daily, they're not just having, like, a stable of pundits being like, what do you think about this thing that's happened
right.
that you can't possibly have researched? They're having, like, a specific person who spent probably months or weeks at least studying that story
exactly.
and like reporting it, like, to talk about it. Yeah.
Right. Instead of, nine people together yelling at each other about their opinions. Yeah.
So tell your parents to
modern,
listen to Daily.
Like the modern state of cable news, especially as it like applies to politics, is like if you went to it's like if you hired six really good looking people to diagnose cars. And like had them run a mechanic shop, and it's like, well, but they don't know anything about like cars. They're just good looking people who are good at talking. It's dumb. It's bad. It's killing us all.
America loves cars.
Speaking of stills, I'm going to start operating an illegal whiskey still in order to keep myself sane throughout the election. That's going to be the worst year of all of our lives. Would you guys like to do an episode where we drink my homemade moonshine and possibly go blind live on the air? We can live stream it.
Oh, can I do that without going blind?
Okay. No.
All right, fuck it. You only live once, right?
You only live once, and I'm well informed. You only go blind once.
That's true.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's good. Just get it out of the way. Kind of like me sharing my first section here on our new show.
Mm-hmm. Yogbado.
We've kind of run out of time, so we have to wrap this one up and continue sharing all of our research on another episode.
Yeah, we're going to have a part two. It'll be on the day that this comes out, too. Yeah, so if you're listening to it, don't worry. You don't have to wait. Just go get the second one.
Yeah.
Now, guys, isn't this just a shameless attempt to get more downloads?
Yep.
Okay. I would say it's an attempt to make
downloads?
Not a 2.5 hour podcast.
Also that.
That's also
but
fair.
Also, I feel no shame about it.
Oh, no shame. No shame. No,
no,
no shame.
Yeah. No, the beauty of the post-truth era is that shame is dead, because no matter how shameful we act, there's always been Shapiro.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. You got your
speaking of which... I have some brain pills to sell.
Thank God. I could use them.
Do they work?
Well, they're not commercial brain pills.
They'll make you go blind.
Some people say they're just psilocybin mushrooms that I ground up and poured into a cup with my morning coffee.
Would you say that?
Yes.
Is that the magical kind? Yes. Is that the magical kind? Because I'm looking for a place to buy mushrooms. So great.
Well, Katie, I think that's a conversation for our next 2020 podcast. I'm looking for a place to buy mushrooms, which...
Catchy, real catchy. Yeah.
All right, we have to wrap
I'll
this...
I'll work on that theme song tonight.
All right, we have to wrap this up now, but we're going to be back immediately. Mm-hmm. So you're welcome.
Yeah, we're going to say goodbye and then we're going to say hello.
We're
going to say goodbye, and we're all going to be played out by our theme song, which, if my notes are correct, was written and performed by the inimitable Bob Dylan. So,
that's correct.
It's true.
Let's roll it.
Prove us wrong.
Real quick, if you want to find us, you can check out our website, worstyearpod.com. You can check us on Twitter, worstyearpod, or on Instagram, worstyearpod. On Instagram.
That is easy to remember.
Did I do all those right? I was reading.
You nailed it.
I was reading off of Sophie's screen across the table, and I've got bad eyes, so I.
God,
guessing.
I love professionalism. Wait, I really
have
love professionalism.
Wait, really have
I'm just waiting. Just
pull off the band aid. Speaking of band aids, here's Bob Dylan.
So dumb, and it's gonna get dumber.
Great.
I tried.
Yes.
Daniel.
Lovely.
Worst Year Ever is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.